We're going to be looking at Ecclesiastes chapter 9 today, and so you can go ahead and turn there. And as we think about this chapter, I want us to first think about the act of giving gifts in life. Because really, you know, we think a lot about receiving gifts, but one of the best things that we can do in life is to give gifts to people that we care about. And if you're a kid or a parent or you've watched kids, you've ever been in, you know, watched nieces or nephews or family members open up presents, you know that there's something that can be almost like magical on Christmas morning or at a birthday party, whenever a kid sees a pile of presents that is for them. And they wait with kind of eager anticipation about what's in those presents. And it's great for the kids when they get to open that present, but oftentimes it can be even more satisfying for the parent or for whoever gave them that present to see a kid get so excited and to kind of triumphantly raise that gift up in the air or want to open it immediately and forgets about the rest of the presents. There's just this special thing about giving gifts to people that we care about. The same's true with people when we care about, you know, romantic relationships, spouses, or people that we're with, and you go through this process when you're getting someone a gift, hopefully, if you don't forget that you're getting them a gift, or you're not rushing, you go through this process that includes thoughtfulness about what they would like, that includes preparation about kind of getting a gift specifically made for them or designed for them, that shows this, you know, this selectivity in what you're picking out for this person that you care about. And it's nice for that person to receive that gift, but lots of times when it's a surprise, there's this sort of anticipation that the giver feels as they watch and they wait to see if the person will like the gift that they've been given. Whether it's a child, a romantic relationship, a family member, or a friend, there's this great thing that we experience when we give things to other people. And there's this statement that's made rounds, you know, that it's better to give than it is to receive. And we say that in a lot of circles, religious circles, secular circles. Lots of people would affirm that kind of statement. One thing that lots of people don't know is that that's a statement based off something that Jesus said. And it's not something Jesus said that's recorded in the Gospels, but in Acts. In Acts chapter 20, verse 35, Paul provides us with this quote from Jesus, where it says, "In everything I did, I showed you that by this kind of hard work we must help the weak, remembering the words the Lord Jesus himself said, 'It is more blessed to give than to receive.'" We've heard this kind of sentiment, it's better to give than to receive, it's more blessed to give than to receive, over and over again throughout culture, through people that have written books, through people that have been activists, through all kinds of people who have spoken about what it's like to give and receive. We see this in the words of the extremely quotable, kind of cited in throughout all Christian circles, that Francis of Assisi, where he said at one point, kind of expanding on this passage, he said, "For it is in giving that we receive." So kind of to think, almost to take it one step further. So not just it's better to be someone who's giving than someone who's receiving, but he says really it's in this act of giving, of whether it's serving people, helping people, giving something like a gift to someone else, that in that moment, that feeling that gives us, there's something we receive in that. In a short novel by Charles Dickens called Dr. Marigold, he has this line in there where he says, "No one is useless in this world who lightens the burdens of another." The same kind of idea, that there's this sort of intrinsic value in life as we seek to help other people, as we seek to give of ourselves for other people. In a Time magazine interview in 1975, there's Dorothy Day, who was a Catholic political activist and someone that spent much of her life advocating for and seeking to serve people who were disadvantaged. And she said this in her interview with Time magazine, "The best things to do with the best things in life is to give them away. That we can't hold on to things, that we should be people who share them." And and similar maybe to Francis of Assisi, the often quoted and often misquoted Mark Twain in his writing Following the Equator said, to get the full value of a joy, you must have somebody to divide it with. And he talks about this idea of sharing life with another person. And he's saying, there's a joy that happens as we give of ourselves to other people. So throughout time, this sentiment that was spoken by Christ, that it's more blessed to give than it is to receive, is something that's been affirmed over and over again. And in Ecclesiastes chapter 9, what we observe in this chapter is really one of the greatest gifts that we can experience in life that's been given to us by a God who created the world and who cares deeply about us. And so this morning, how we're going to look at this chapter is that, you know, there have been weeks where we read sections of the chapter and then we go back and talk about it, or weeks where we read a verse and talk about it. We're going to read through all of Ecclesiastes chapter 9. It's a pretty short chapter. And then we're going to talk about some of the passages that are here. So if you turn to Ecclesiastes 9, we're going to start right in verse 1. And Solomon says this, "So I reflected on all this and concluded that the righteous and the wise in what they do are in God's hands, but no one knows whether love or hate awaits them. All share a common destiny. The righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad, the clean and the unclean, those who offer sacrifices and those who do not. As it is with the good, so with the sinful. As it is with those who take oaths, so with those who are afraid to take them. This is the evil in everything that happens under the sun. The same destiny overtakes all. The hearts of people, moreover, are full of evil, and there is madness in their hearts while they live, and afterward they join the dead. Anyone who is among the living has hope. Even a live dog is better off than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. They have no further reward, and even their name is forgotten. Their love, their hate, and their jealousy have long since vanished. Never again will they have a part in anything that happens under the sun. Go, eat your food with gladness, and drink your wine with a joyful heart, for God has already approved what you do. Always be clothed in white and always anoint your head with oil. Enjoy life with your wife whom you love all the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun, all your meaningless days. For this is your lot in life and in your toilsome labor under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. For in the realm of the dead where you are going, there is neither working nor planning nor knowledge nor wisdom. I have seen something else under the sun. The race is not to the swift, or the battle to the strong, nor does food come to the wise, or wealth to the brilliant, or favor to the learned. But time and chance happen to them all. Moreover, no one knows when their hour will come. As fish are caught in a cruel net, or birds are taken in a snare, so people are trapped by evil times that fall unexpectedly upon them. I also saw under the sun this example of wisdom that greatly impressed me. There was once a small city with only a few people in it, and a powerful king came against it, surrounded it, and built huge siege works against it. Now there lived in that city a man poor but wise, and he saved the city by his wisdom. But nobody remembered that poor man. So I said, wisdom is better than strength. But the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are no longer heeded. The quiet words of the wise are more to be heeded than the shouts of a ruler of fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good." And as we read through this chapter, what we see right in the beginning of this chapter is that Solomon, he's kind of getting ready to land this plane. He's kind of getting ready to pull this ship into the harbor. And even though there are a few more chapters left, he begins this by saying, as he's observed all of this. And when he says that, he's kind of looking back at this book, at the conditions of life that he's described up to this point, and he's offering kind of his summation of his observations that he's made. And again, as a reminder, When we see this word, these words about meaninglessness, when we see these words about vanity, when we see this kind of repetitious nature, Solomon is repeating these things because they are foreign to us and because we need time to consider them and allow them to sink into our minds. Throughout these first eight chapters, Solomon has said over and over and over again that the normal things that people build their lives around and the normal things that we look to find meaning in don't work. They don't add up in the end. They don't satisfy the desires that we have. He has said over and over again that we should be people that live in such a way that we remember our death is coming. And this is something that we subconsciously or consciously try to suppress nearly all the time. Our natural inclination is to ignore it, and Solomon says we should be people that live in that knowledge. He has said over and over again that the status of all people are equal in the sense that we will all meet a common fate. He has said that rich people are no better off than poor people, that people that party are no happier than people who are somber and don't party, that people who are wise still die in just the same kind of manner than people who live in a fashion that is unwise. That people who use others to meet their own ends and who appear to gain a level of status and success are no better than the people that they used and stepped on in order to get that level of success. He's rejected the notions we advance all the time that living in wisdom and caution can free us from experiencing tragedy. And that is something that we don't like to acknowledge or live with. He's pointed out that regardless of how we choose to live, there is not a promise that anyone can make to us that a great accident won't befall us at some point in our family. There's no promise that our happiness will not turn to mourning, that our riches will not turn to poverty, that our wisdom will not end in folly and accident. And really, the only great promise that we have in life is death. These are hard truths for us to be able to hear, and even after thousands of years of Christians, of believers, who would look at the words of Solomon and the instructions and say these are the inspired, authoritative words of God, this is a truth that many of us don't live with or acknowledge in our lives. The things that Solomon shares are not popular for us to discuss when we get together at Bible study, when we're sharing prayer requests, when we're talking with our spouse about our hopes and our dreams for the future, when we're instructing our kids. We don't often look to these kinds of words. And if we were honest and step back, and this is all of us, certainly myself included, many of us would have to look in the mirror and admit that too often we live for things that are vain and meaningless. That too often we've lived for money and we've hoped that the accrual of money would be something that provides a sense of meaning to our lives or provides a sense of happiness and joy to our lives. Too often we've lived for our own sense of pleasure in life as a way to find meaning and value in our lives. Too often we've lived with a way where we weren't really concerned about the way that we treat others as long as we're feeling a level of fulfillment in what's taking place in our lives. And certainly, too often we deny the reality that one day we will pass from this life. That one day we won't have the opportunity to speak with people that we love anymore. That one day we won't have the opportunity to go on vacation with our kids anymore. That one day we won't have the ability to say that we're sorry after we have a fight with someone. And in denying our passing, we oftentimes misuse the time that we have in life with other people. And at times, We look at the book of Ecclesiastes in this sense, and we see it as this really negative slant in life. And when something says that life is meaningless and vain over and over again, and when something says to focus in on our death over and over again, it appears to be that way. It's easy to read it in that kind of sense. But there's nothing in Ecclesiastes where Solomon says to us that we should abstain from happiness, that we should abstain from money and reject it and burn it, that we should abstain from wisdom, and that we should intentionally seek out living in folly. He doesn't tell us that we should sit in a dark room sulking and crying and waiting for the end of our life to happen. Far from it. The book helps to change our perspective on life and death as we pursue to live now with a sense of meaning and purpose. And so in this regard, in chapter 9, Solomon teaches, or really he reteaches for us several important lessons, three things about what it means for us to live well here and now. One of these things that we see is that there's really only one certainty in life, and that is death. And there's, you know, our popular kind of the colloquial saying that we'll often hear, that the only two certainties in life are death and taxes. And Solomon would say, that's not true. You could live without taxes, but in a glass half full kind of way, you can live without taxes, but death is something that is going to affect all of us. Death is something that's going to befall all of us. The message that Solomon communicates is one that's very rational, that the end of life in our fallen world is death. We see this in Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verses 2 and 3, where he says this: all share a common destiny, the righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad, the clean and the unclean, those who offer sacrifices and those who do not. As it is with the good, so with the sinful. As it is with those who take oaths, so with those who are afraid to take them. This is the evil in everything that happens under the sun. The same destiny overtakes all. Solomon describes that we have this common destiny at the end of our lives, and he continues to wrestle with one element of this. In this passage, when he says this is the evil, he's not talking about death itself and that all of life ends in death. That is an evil. That's something that's corrected by our Savior. That's something that's corrected when God's kingdom is consummated and completed, that life will not end in death. But what Solomon's talking about in verse 3 when he talks about this evil is that he's saying, look, the wise and the unwise meet the same end. Good people and bad people meet the same end. The evil he's talking about is this lack of certainty that there's no really good and wise and righteous way, or words that we can say or actions that we can take, that will assure us that we won't die like someone who's unrighteous and unwise and who doesn't take care of their lives. We have this sense when we read through the book of Ecclesiastes, and many of us have probably known or at least heard of people who experience something like this, where you'll have someone who's a healthy person, who's, you know, someone who exercises, who's conscious about what they eat, who takes care of their body, who goes to their regular doctor's appointments, and then still has some kind of tragedy that befalls them and they pass away. And on the other end of the spectrum, you have people who live to be 100 who are addicted to curly fries at Arby's. And there's this kind of reason that we find hard to make sense of this. You know, and Solomon says, this is the evil. That you have good people and bad people, but the good people don't live longer than the bad people necessarily. That you have people who are healthy and unhealthy, and the healthy people don't necessarily live longer than the unhealthy people. And when he calls it an evil, he doesn't just say it's an evil, but he says that this is an evil that happens to us under the sun. And that phrase, under the sun, in this life, is something that we've seen over and over again, where Solomon's talked about the limitations of perspective that we have as people. That we can't understand God. in so many ways. God has a knowledge that is vast beyond what we are able to comprehend. That when bad things happen, we don't have the ability oftentimes to make sense of why something bad would happen to me and not to this person who's a much worse person than I am. We don't have that ability to be able to understand many of the reasonings for things under the sun. And so in this sense, what Solomon says is that there's this evil that we can't understand about the way death works. And then in verse 4, he says this about death. Anyone who is among the living has hope. Even a live dog is better off than a dead lion. And this is, you know, kind of an intense way of looking at life and highlights that as we're here and now under the sun, we have opportunities to do things that we will not have the opportunity to do when we are dead. There are things we can do now that we won't be able to do later. There are things we can experience now that we won't be able to experience later. There are things that we have now and can obtain now that we can't take with us after death. And this isn't, again, this isn't a call from Solomon to live in this kind of depressing light, but really, it's this exhortation to live in a way that is meaningful while we have the opportunity to do so. And Solomon, again, we talked about this earlier, he doesn't advocate that there is no afterlife and that there is nothing that we do after we pass from this life. He makes it very clear that he doesn't know what befalls us. But even at the beginning of this chapter, he says we don't know what waits, love or hate for us on the other end. He advances that there is an afterlife. He makes it clear he doesn't know what that looks like, but that there are things that we can do now that we won't be able to do later. And in doing so, Ecclesiastes teaches us that death is certain, that long life is not certain, and that as a result we should live well while we have the chance. And then later on in the chapter, it teaches us a few things about life that are also uncertain for us. In verse 11, it says this, I have seen something else under the sun. The race is not to the swift, or the battle to the strong, nor does food come to the wise, or wealth to the brilliant, or favor to the learned, but time and chance happen to them all. So death is certain. And then in verse 11, Solomon gives this list of things that are uncertain for us. And he has this, that it's uncertain that the fastest people will finish first. That it's uncertain that the battle will be won by the people that are strong. That it's uncertain that the wise people in life will not starve. That it's uncertain that the brilliant, the intelligent, the really smart people around us will become rich. That it's uncertain that a good life is guaranteed, that the way he talks about a life of favor is guaranteed to people who are well educated. And if we look at this list, there's a part of us when we read that where we feel like a level of excitement. When we read that list and we think that it's not always, you know, for me it's exciting to think that maybe the fast people won't always win the race. You know, we can look and we can kind of look at areas where we see ourselves as deficient and say, hey, this is good news. That it doesn't mean the fast, the strong, the wise, the advantaged, the rich, that they'll get everything. We all kind of love a good underdog story. You know, we love the story where in a race where someone's able to really gut out a victory with heart, even though they didn't have the physical ability, that they shouldn't have had the physical ability to be able to beat someone. We all love kind of the story of David and Goliath because it's this underdog story. We love sports stories where a team that, you know, is scrappy is able to pull it together and beat a team that's a powerhouse. We love in life stories when someone from a humble situation is able to kind of rise above what should be their station in life to achieve wealth or success or favor that many people thought wouldn't be possible for them to be able to achieve. If we think about this on one sense, we love the story of the underdog. We like that people who are better than us in certain areas may not always kind of be ahead of us in life. But the truth of the matter is that even while we love watching Lifetime movies about underdogs, we don't ever want to be the underdog in life. We don't ever want to be the people that have the odds stacked against us. We don't ever want to be the person who's in that kind of position. We want to be the fast, the strong, the wise, the rich, the advantaged, well-educated people that live a good life. Because we know that even if the fast don't always win the race, most of the time, they're going to win the race. And since this is what that passage is teaching us, and this is kind of what we aspire to be, the fast and the strong and the wise and the wealthy, the passage reads a lot more like a cautionary tale than it does like a retelling of the movie Rudy. And it goes on to say this in verse 12. Moreover, no one knows when their hour will come. As fish are caught in a cruel net or birds are taken in a snare, so people are trapped by evil times that fall unexpectedly upon them. There are so many things about life that are just uncertainties for us. Pastor David Gibson points out an interesting contrast about Ecclesiastes chapter 9 when he says, we tend to live as if the one thing that is certain will never come, our death, while the many things that are uncertain are certain. He's saying we tend to live in this way. There's one certainty that encompasses all of us, that at the end of our lives we will die. We ignore that reality as we think about how we're going to live. And instead, we focus our lives around being the fast and the strong and the rich and the wise and the well-educated, even though those things aren't certain. Even though those things can be gone in an accident, in a moment's notice. We build our lives around a perspective that can be taken away from us at any time. And with this certainty of death in mind, and these uncertainties of life in mind, there's a message in Ecclesiastes chapter 9 about how we should live well. So if you'll begin reading with me in verse 7 and 8, it says this, go, eat your food with gladness, and drink your wine with a joyful heart, for God has already approved what you do. That doesn't sound like a pronouncement to stop pursuing a good life. That doesn't sound like an announcement to sit in a room and wait for your end to come with this reality that death will take us all. He goes on to say this, always be clothed in white and always anoint your head with oil. Last week we read about the story of Job. We read the story of a man who began mourning life while he was living. And it says that when Job began this process of mourning, he put on sackcloth and ashes. He put on black as this sign of mourning. And this is the same practice that was common throughout the Old Testament when people were repenting of sin, where they'd put on sackcloth and ashes, where they would enter into this state of kind of a mournful repentance of what they had done to sin in the eyes of God. It's really the same notion that we have today when we put on black clothes, when we go to attend a funeral. It's this physical sign of mourning that we practice. And so Solomon, even while he's telling us to live consciously aware of our death, he tells us to live in a way that we reject the things we often build up as our source of meaning, that we embrace the reality of death, and yet that we do not engage in mourning. He actually advocates for the opposite of mourning. He instructs us to put on white and to be anointed with oil. This imagery of putting on white and being anointed with oil is one clear in the Old Testament of experiencing the blessing of God. We see that in places like the prophecy of Zechariah where he's appearing before God in this vision and he has this dream that his robes are filthy and dirty and that the accuser is kind of pointing out how filthy and dirty his robes are. And then in a reference to Christ in the prophecy, it talks about how he's given fresh and clean and white robes to put on. Throughout the Old Testament, repeatedly, we see this act of the head being anointed with oil as a way of consecrating someone for the purposes of God, as a way of displaying the blessing of God on their life. And even in this passage, what it's referring to in lots of ways is just the physical appearance of having yourself look good in life. The teacher tells us to eat our food with gladness, to drink our wine with a joyful heart, to clothe ourselves in a manner that expresses our happiness. He goes on after verse 8 and he tells people to enjoy the spouse that they have in their life, in their life that they love. He tells people to work hard in their life while they have the opportunity to work hard. He doesn't ever give this message of resignation even while he's calling life meaningless. Even in that passage, when he goes on to talk about life with a spouse and he says, enjoy them all the days of your meaningless life, in all the meaningless days God would provide for you, it almost begins to take on this tone, really of meaningless, appearing to be kind of a defiant sort of statement. This recognition, yes, if we live life for here and now under the sun, if we place our meaning in the wrong things, our life is meaningless. But we shouldn't be people who accept that resignation to meaninglessness. We should be people that live well here and now. And really, what Ecclesiastes chapter 9 is awakening us to is the reality that life is not about earning our gain. It is about receiving our gift. Life is not about what we can get. It is not about what we can achieve. It is not about what we can manufacture. It is not about the meaning that we can find or create for ourselves. It is not about wealth or wisdom or work. Life is not about earning our gain. It is about receiving our gift. Life is a gift from God that is intended for us to enjoy. And when we look around at the world and we encounter each and every day this kind of radical and profound idea that we should be enjoying life instead of seeking our gain, we're able to live in a way that is meaningful because we recognize that the opportunities that we have, that the people that are in our lives, they are a gift from God. And so we need to be a people that stop trying to do it all and to receive the gift from the one who has done it all on our behalf. We need to be people that stop creating these false idols of wealth and even of wisdom, that we need to stop building up our lives around these areas that are meaningless and that our culture encourages us to bow down to every day and to find satisfaction in the gift that the one true God has offered us, a life of fulfillment, a life of meaning. We need to be people that stop attributing our meaning and our effort and our emotions to things that are uncertain and that start living in recognition of what is certain and taking each day as a gift from our Creator. And I don't need to tell many of you where this is headed, but we see that ultimate example of the gift of life in the person of Jesus, the one who came to free us from this cycle of looking for meaning in all the wrong places and ensuring that even though we share in the common fate of death, we will not be a victim to a meaningless life, and that life at the end of our days under the sun isn't the end of our story. And this idea of Jesus as a gift is the way that he described himself in John chapter 4. There's this moment where Jesus is meeting with the Samaritan woman at the well, and they're talking about water and about drinking water while they're there. And she has no idea who Jesus is, that he's the Messiah, that he's the Son of God. She's at this point in the conversation, she's unaware of all of that. And at one point, Jesus says to her, if you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water. And we have a powerful opportunity to receive that same living water from Christ, to receive that gift of life from God. And we don't just have the powerful opportunity to receive that, but we have the opportunity as God's people and as a church to live out a testimony in a world that is filled with people who are looking for meaning in being the fastest and the strongest and the wisest and the wealthiest and the best advantaged, to set the example that we don't find meaning in those things, but that we find meaning when we receive life as a gift instead of trying to earn our meaning. And so if you've been a believer for 30 minutes or 30 years, I would invite you to take some time to think about the way that you live, to think about the way that you respond to the things in life that are certain, the thing in life that is certain, and the things in life that are uncertain. And to evaluate what is it that you orient your heart and your life and your sense of meaning around. And if it's anything other than receiving the gift of God, to realign your heart and your life around Christ and around the word that we have from him, that he is the gift of God that provides us with life.